Welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense come back. I'm Brandi Cruz. Nice to be back. Had Friday off. As you know, I went wedding dress shopping with my mom and my sister. They were in town. We had a lot of fun. And I found the prettiest wedding dress. I trolled all of you on social media with a picture of it. Of course, I'm not going to show a picture of my wedding dress before the big day. But I just felt very much like a bride for the first time. So I'm excited. I know you don't want to keep hearing about my wedding, but you know, I'm jazzed about it. So I appreciate the time off from you. You're just very generous bosses. I had a really good time, but it is back to business today. We're going to be talking about the police killing of Tyre Nichols in Memphis and some of the narratives that have arisen out of that. What is really a tragic and brutal encounter. Also coming up, some updates on some stories we've been following that have to do with people-powered movements and you being your own best watchdogs. For instance, we've been talking about this case of an opioid clinic that was scheduled to open in Lynnwood, Washington, near a Boys and Girls Club. The public fought back, but it now seems we have an answer as to what's going to happen up there in Lynnwood, so we'll check in. But first, I want to talk about an article that I published last night. Many of you, I'm sure, have already read it. It's up on Patreon and Locals. If you're not a subscriber, there's no paywall for this article, so you can go read it. Patreon.com/undivided or brandicruz.locals.com. The headline is "The Weak War on Reasonable People." And in it, I talk about this painting of moderates and centrists as extremists. You know, I kind of mentioned this on social media last week, that you have like people like Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, who are very moderate Democrats, who are just vilified by their own party in Congress and, you know, painted as these extremists when they're really not the ones who are extremists. And, you know, I really feel that a lot in Washington State and in Seattle. I'm often painted as this right-wing extremist when I consider myself a moderate independent, when I feel like I have views that, you know, can fall on one side, can fall on the other side. And it doesn't mean I'm a fence walker. I think some people confuse moderate or centrist for just walking a fence and not committing to any opinions. I do commit to opinions. They just don't all fall perfectly within a political party. And that's why I consider myself an independent. And I also believe that bipartisanship, working together, working across the aisle, is what leads to the best policies. And so in that sense, I'm a moderate. I really do believe that when you come together, the outcome is a better policy than if you have one party dictating everything like we see in Washington State. So a little background on why I wrote this article, because I really wrestled with whether to publish something over the weekend. So I've been doing a lot of paid speeches since I left corporate media, and I've really enjoyed it. You know, a lot of them are political in nature, where I get to go out and give my political opinions on things. A lot of them are delivered to politically aligned organizations. And in the last year, I've started charging for those speeches. It's an important part of my ability to make enough money to do the podcast full time. And so, you know, doing these speeches is, I like it. It's very fun, but it's also part of my income. But I got a request last month that I thought was very unique and interesting. The Kent Chamber of Commerce asked me to be a speaker, the keynote speaker at their 2023 Women's Wellness Luncheon. So the way this was pitched to me is that it wasn't going to be political. We weren't talking about politics. It was about empowering women in the workplace. And specifically, they wanted me to deliver a keynote address on my decision to leave corporate media, to branch out on my own, to start my own business and my own podcast. And I thought, that's great. I would love to talk about that. I also plan to talk about a few things that can be difficult for women, but I think really anyone in the workplace, and that is negotiating salary and also just dealing with the stress of a high-stress job. And having worked in television news, those are two things that I think I'm very good at, but also keenly aware of. You know, I negotiated my own salary at Fox 13 for years without an agent, when a lot of people in the business were using an agent. And I think I have a lot of good tips to offer on doing that, because I think I was able to negotiate my salary very successfully. I mean, when I left TV, I was paid very, very well. And that's a salary that I got for myself without the help of an agent. So I look forward to offering some tips and tricks on that. And then as far as stress goes, you know, television news, and it's certainly not the only stressful job in America, but it was difficult. Not only the fast-paced nature of the job, but also the outside stressors, you know, that you get from viewers, from critics, etc. The stress to always get things right, the stress to look good on television. So I just thought that this was a great opportunity to empower other women, to help give other women advice who want to branch out on their own in some way, start their own business, etc. So I was really excited to do it. The speech was set for March 8th, and it was going to be paid. So anyway, after I had initially agreed to it last month, I got a call, or I had a couple text messages from the Kent Chamber of Commerce saying they needed to talk to me about something. And I was like, okay, you know. And we ended up having a phone call Friday evening. And I kind of got this bad feeling going into the phone call, but, you know, just to put it in context, I was having such a good day. Because I'd gone dress shopping, wedding dress shopping with all my friends there, my mom there, my sister there, picked out a wedding dress, was just feeling awesome, like feeling very just good about myself and all of that. And then got home from this awesome day, had this phone call. Within the first like 30 seconds of the phone call, I was like, oh my God. So as the Kent Chamber of Commerce, as well as the past president of the Kent Chamber of Commerce. So immediately I was sort of like, okay, what? Why does the past president need to be on this phone call? It was very strange. And immediately they kind of dove into the fact that there had been some complaints from members of the Kent Chamber of Commerce who were going to attend this luncheon about my participation as the keynote and my ability to be the keynote speaker. So I'm like, great, okay, here we go. And specifically, they said that there were complaints about three different things. One of them is my longtime friendship with the late Dory Monson. As you guys know, Dory Monson, who passed away on New Year's Eve, who was a host at Cairo Radio for 27 years in Seattle, you know, leaned conservative, was a dear friend of mine. I mean, one of my most important mentors in my life and in my career. And in 27 years on the radio, an illustrious career, wonderful ratings, Dory had one slip up. He sent out a tweet that was meant as a joke about how Democrats say they're the party of science, yet they let people change their gender on their birth certificate. So anyway, the cancel culture came for Dory. He ended up being taken off the radio for a few weeks. You know, got put back on, but it was this whole ordeal. And at the time, I posted something on Facebook about it, basically saying, like, look, I don't think the tweet was great, but I'm not going to disown my friend over it. That's ridiculous. So anyway, one of the things the Kent Chamber of Commerce said people had complained about is essentially me sticking up for my friend Dory Monson when the whole transgender controversy happened. And so immediately I'm like, oh my God, are they really bringing up Dory Monson, who we haven't even had a funeral for, as like a complaint about me that I can't speak at this women's wellness conference or something? So I was immediately like on the defensive and pissed off and a little amused. Like, I can't believe we're actually having this conversation. And then they said another thing that some anonymous people had complained about. I mean, I'm sure not anonymous to the chamber, but no, I don't know who they were, was that I went on the Tim Pool podcast last year, Timcast. Is Tim Pool quote unquote controversial? I guess. But why would I have to answer for everything Tim Pool has ever said by virtue of having appeared once on his podcast? I can't speak with anyone who is outside the mainstream or who other people might not agree with. Like, I have to absorb everything that they've ever said that I don't agree with. That's stupid. Timcast, going on that, millions of viewers, was a wonderful, tremendous opportunity for me in my career. And so I'm just like, first of all, the fact that people would complain about that shows how thin-skinned they are and what a bubble they live in. And then the third thing that the complaint that was brought to the Kent Chamber was a commentary I did last year. You might remember it. I'll play a clip just to remind you. But it was about these leaders of BIPOC nonprofits being awarded $60,000 sabbaticals, so paid vacations, based on nothing but the color of their skin. And as you guys know, I'm firmly against identitarianism and lifting people up specifically based on some immutable characteristic like their skin color or their gender. I think that's silly. I think it's taking this country backwards. Here's the commentary that people apparently had a problem with.
Like, if this is just people who donated to these nonprofits and they're using this money for vacations for folks, whatever, and I agree. But this is an organization that has benefited from taxpayer money. So during Chaz Chop, et cetera, the city was trying to appease some of these BIPOC organizations by basically just giving them money, saying, hey, we're going to give you money for community programs to try to appease you, to try to get you to leave Chop. It was a bribe with taxpayer money. And one of the things that this organization got, so Beard Bar Place, BIPOC Ed is part of that. And they got $1 million in 2020 because they got transferred ownership of a former fire station to be their kind of permanent place to do business out of. And then they got a bunch of money and grants to renovate this former fire station. So you have this organization that has been the beneficiary of taxpayer funds for what I would argue is a questionable reason. This was, again, just, it was essentially a bribe. The city of Seattle was throwing at organizations to get them to calm down in the summer of 2020 and not destroy the city, et cetera. And then this organization goes on to spend $1.37 million for vacations for their executive directors to, quote, heal from multi-generational trauma. BIPOC leaders need rest and restoration in order to heal from multi-generational trauma and years of nonstop working on behalf of their communities to recharge for the work ahead.
So anyway, you know, when these things were brought up, and I'll say of the Kent Chamber when they called, I don't think that they found me problematic because, after all, they asked me to be the keynote. But I think they felt pressured from this fringe person or persons who apparently just cannot be in the same room as someone who they don't agree with. I think they felt pressured to bring these issues to my attention. So I don't believe the call. And they said that the call was not about asking me not to be the keynote. But I'll tell you the truth. Immediately once they brought up Dory Monson, in my mind, I'm like, I'm not gonna speak at this event. Because I thought, like, how insignificant of a complaint, how petty of a complaint is that? Where my friendship with someone who recently passed away is somehow being used against me as a negative. I was deeply offended and pissed off. So immediately, you know, the conversation continued, but immediately I was like, I'm not going to be the keynote for this event. So, you know, I start to sort of defend myself against this sort of like idea that I'm somehow, you know, some people find me too extreme to speak at an event empowering women. And, you know, they brought up some things because I was going to give a keynote and then be on a panel with other women and answer questions. And they said, well, there was a concern raised about, you know, what you might say if you're asked whether you think Black women or transgender women have a harder time in the workplace. To which I said, well, I don't think I'd offer an opinion on that. How would I know whether Black women or transgender women have a harder time in the workplace, given that I'm neither Black nor transgender? I just can't imagine ever offering my opinion about that. Now, I would say that I don't believe that we need to be giving people special or preferential treatment based on the color of their skin or their sexual identity or orientation. Again, because I think as a country, that would be going backward. And then they threw out this really weird sentence about, like, or that you might say that you think Donald Trump should be the president. And I'm like, that's when I was like, wow. And I'm trying to hold back laughter during this conversation because I'm like, anyone who's ever listened to my podcast knows I don't like Donald Trump. Never voted for him. Don't want him to run again. And so whoever brought that to their attention is like just making assumptions about me that are totally baseless. But also, and I thought to myself, well, what if I did like Donald Trump? 74 million Americans voted for the guy. I'm sure some of them are going to be at this women's empowerment luncheon. I thought you told me this wasn't political. You specifically told me it wasn't a political event. My speech was not going to be political. So why are politics being brought up? Why are my politics being questioned? Are you not going to allow people in the door who supported the former president? So in addition to that just being a silly assertion, I don't understand why it should matter. And so anyway, you know, I kind of got to the point where I'm like, why am I even justifying this? And I said, you know, good luck in your event. You know, I'm going to save you the trouble. It is not an event that I'm interested in speaking at anymore. And that's when the former president of the chamber basically said, well, that's not what this call was about. You know, we weren't going to ask you not to do that. I'm like, I know, but I don't want to. So it doesn't matter whether you were going to ask me or not. I'm just not interested in doing it anymore. But, you know, the point of, again, going back to the article I posted yesterday, the headline, The Weak War on Reasonable People, it wasn't meant to be this sort of, woe is me, I was attacked and not allowed to, and I'm going to drop out of giving this keynote. Like, it's not really about that. I'm kind of used to that. But I think part of me, and I hope this can relate to a lot of you who feel stuck in the middle of the extremes, who feel silenced as a moderate or misunderstood as a centrist, and, you know, feel like you can't say something or you're outside the mainstream. You are in the mainstream. We as a society have like almost accepted the extremes as the mainstream. And I think it's because they're louder and people are more afraid to stand up for them. And, you know, for a long time in Seattle, I've been painted as this like right wing Nazi Barbie, Seattle's Ann Coulter, or whatever names they've come up with for me. And I used to just sort of, you know, I got to the point where I could kind of dismiss it like this is just a symptom of a problem we're having nationally with polarization. But when I got that call, I'm like, hell no. Like this is one of those things where we just can't be passive about it. We can't passively accept this war on reasonable, rational people. And when someone like me, or I mean, there's a million other examples of people who have moderate, reasonable politics, left of right, or left of center, right of center, who get vilified, who get outright vilified. And, you know, I think it's time that we really push back against those narratives and stop letting the extremes define who is extreme. And I really think that's what happened here. I think you have a few people who were on the far left who planned to attend this event, who had some perception of me, and they defined me as extreme, as opposed to them being the ones that are extreme. In the article, I give this example of police defunding. You had members of the Seattle City Council who supported police defunding. That is a position that is more extreme than any position I've ever held. Yet it's not treated that way. Why? And it's because the media has, you know, treated the extremes in Seattle as the mainstream when that shouldn't be normalized. I also give the example in the article of, you know, when we talk about my friendship with Dory Monson being something that's problematic. Dory was no further to the right than most Seattle politicians are to the left. Yet he's the extremist and they're not. And I take issue with that. But I also pointed out, for instance, that there are Democrats who have much more problematic friendships and relationships that no one seems to take issue with. Over the weekend, the Washington State Democratic Party elected Shasti Conrad to be the new chair of the state party. And she has not only a lot of extreme views outside the mainstream, but she's aligned herself with extreme people. Do you remember Nicole Thomas Kennedy, the police abolitionist who ran for Seattle City Attorney and thank God lost, and who it turned out had tweeted out all these insane things. She called cops serial killers, said she had a rabid hatred of the police, supported an arson at the youth jail, celebrated people who set off an explosive device at the East Police Precinct. Well, Shasti Conrad, who at the time was the chair of the King County Democratic Party, not only did she support Nicole Thomas Kennedy's campaign, even after all those revelations, she called her a visionary and she condemned two former Democratic governors who spoke out against Nicole Thomas Kennedy for those tweets. So here you have someone like Shasti Conrad who has aligned herself in the past with probably the most extreme political candidate I've ever covered in my career. Yet she's not shunned. she is elected as the chair of the state Democratic Party. So you can see the hypocrisy of, you know, taking someone like me who is center-right in Seattle, but if you drop me somewhere else in the country, I'd probably be center-left, and painting me as the extremist, me as the problematic one, so problematic, in fact, that I have to justify my relationships and my positions in order to speak at a luncheon about women empowerment. There's something deeply, deeply wrong with that. And until those of us who are in the reasonable middle, left of center, right of center, can stand up for each other, stand up for ourselves and say, absolutely not. We are not going to be painted as the extremists. We are not going to be painted as the problematic ones. We are in the majority. We're going to take our power back. We're going to take our voices back. And we're not going to let the extremes dictate who the extremes are. So that was the reason I decided to write something about this and to talk about this phone call that I had, is I think it's an unfortunate example of people who are reasonable being painted as the extremists. And in order to get our dialogue back on track, our politics back on track, our country back on track, we need to flip that narrative. Speaking of women empowerment, I've been empowering myself by losing my COVID weight, so I feel better about myself. And actually, today I'm starting my second round of the East Side Weight Loss Clinic plan. So the way the program works, you do 60 days initially, and then you take a month off to let your body adjust to your new weight and your new lifestyle. And then if you feel like you need to lose more weight, you can do another round. And I do have about 15 more pounds to lose. So today I'm starting my second round to hopefully lose my last 15 pounds of COVID weight. And so if you're interested and you've been thinking about the program because you've seen how much success I've had on it, losing 25 pounds in 2 months, now's a good day to start, because then we can do it together. And you can email me and be like, here's what I'm going through. And I've already been there. I did the 60 days initially. And so I can definitely offer you some advice on that. So if you would like to check out the East Side Weight Loss Clinic plan, get in shape for the summer, start now. Why wait? Don't wait till March, April, or May. Check them out at eastsideweightlossclinic.com. That's eastsideweightlossclinic.com. Or if you prefer, you can give them a phone call at 425-354-3020. That's 425-354-3020. Dr. Coogan will go through the program with you, answer any questions that you might have about whether it's right for you. Here's who I think can be successful in the program. If you require structure, if you thrive on structure, this is a good program for you, because they're going to tell you exactly what to do, and you just need to do it. And you just need to treat it like a job. It's 60 freaking days of your life. If you need to lose weight, I promise you, if you follow the program, I guarantee you, if you follow the program, you will lose weight. There's just no way that you can't. Also, there's no prepackaged meals. So if you prefer to put your own meals together, this is a great program for you. And you can do it from anywhere. Eastside Weight Loss Clinic is in Kirkland, but you can do it virtually. You don't have to go into the office if you don't want to. I went in initially just to get my body fat composition and my weight from them. And then I weighed myself at home after that. So I've only been in actually one time. So anyway, check out eastsideweightlossclinic.com. Let them know you heard about them on the Undivided podcast, and send me a message or an email if you start the program so that we can do it together. Huge story that broke over the weekend, and kind of while I was off for a few days, was the fatal police beating of Tyre Nichols in Memphis. The video, I'm not going to show too much of it or play too much of it. It's incredibly disturbing. But if you've watched it, I feel like there's pretty universal agreement that it was outside the realm of any reasonable amount of force and is indefensible in every sense. Tyre Nichols was 29 years old. And there's some disagreement about why he was even stopped in the first place. The officers who stopped him said it was a traffic stop for reckless driving. Investigators now looking into it say they can't really determine whether there was probable cause to stop Tyre Nichols. And then he fled on foot from the traffic stop and they beat him to death. I mean, there's video of them winding up, running up and kicking him while he's on the ground. It's absolutely devastating. You know, and I should note, so 5 officers have been charged with murder in the case, relieved of duty. And then this morning, a 6th officer in Memphis was relieved of duty in association with the arrest. So obviously there's outrage across the country, and we've had a couple of these instances now where it feels very undeniable that something went wrong here. But this case is different than others in the sense that the five officers were Black, and Tyree Nichols was Black. And so immediately, you don't have that racial element that the media and critics of the police always jump on and jump to. And that's sort of the easy out and the easy narrative to say, well, this must have been racism, case closed. Now, I will say that didn't stop some outlets from still trying to make it an issue about race. In fact, there was this article from CNN's Van Jones. The headline was, "The police who killed Tyree Nichols were Black, but they might still have been driven by racism," which is just like, oh my God, I'm just over it. So, you know, by and large, the media couldn't, besides weird takes like this from Van Jones, the media couldn't rely on its default on the issue of race. And to me, that will lead to a much more, and hopefully lead to a much more productive conversation about what went wrong here and what can we learn from it. Now, I'm not saying that there aren't some issues involving officers that probably did have to do with race. I'm just saying that that's too quickly the default, as opposed to looking at what else might have been at play. So since that's not at play here, in any reasonable sense, you can look at other issues. And one of the issues that's been raised is at least a couple of these officers were hired under loosened hiring standards by the Memphis Police Department. So the Memphis Police Department in the last couple years to help with recruitment had lowered its recruiting standards twice. The first time around was in 2018. They relaxed requirements for relevant work experience and educational requirements. And then in 2022, they did away with a timed physical ability test, and they also cut back on the number of required college credit hours. Now, to be clear, I don't know if that had anything to do with what happened to Tyree Nichols. In fact, I would argue it probably didn't. Just because you have limited work experience or, you know, didn't take X number of college credit hours when previously they wanted Y, that doesn't make you a violent person. And when I look at the video of this beating, I see people with no regard for human life. And I just don't think that education, work experience give you a regard for human life. I think that you're either wired that way or you're not. That being said, I do believe it brings up an important conversation that we need to have across the country, including in local agencies across the country here in Washington State, about what the police defunding movement, for instance, might do to the quality of officers on a force. Seattle's down like 500 officers, for instance. And so the question is, as you try to, A, diversify departments to better reflect the communities they serve and answer calls for police reform, but B, try to recoup historic staffing losses, and you bring down standards to be able to do that, is that counterproductive to what police reform demands were about in the first place? And, you know, this is something I actually recall being brought up by law enforcement experts and officials at the time of police defunding, which is, hey, if you do this, or if you scare away all the officers who have been there for a long time with a lot of experience, who might retire early, etc., it might lead to a less qualified force, a less experienced force, and therefore a force that is not as connected to the community because they're brand new, and is not as experienced on the streets as to what they might encounter. And so they might make more mistakes like this. And so it was this sort of catch-22. And so I wanted to chat with someone today who might have some insight into how the police staffing deficit might lead to less experienced officers on the beat and officers who might be more prone to make a mistake. The following segment is presented in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. So joining us is Steve Strand, the executive director of the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs. Steve, thanks so much for being here.
Good to be with you.
So obviously I want to ask you about Tyree Nichols. I'm assuming you've seen the video. As a law enforcement professional, how does it hit you?
I think like it does a lot of other people, it's appalling. And not just as a law enforcement officer, as a human being, I think, you know, we all share that. We sent a statement out from the sheriffs and chiefs before the video was released, concurring with what the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives sent out, because I thought it expressed it well. But it talked about the change in how we respond to these things in terms of more immediate action by the chief in Memphis, which I thought was productive and good. You know, but I will say, reasonable question from that is, how do we make sure that that doesn't happen again anywhere, especially in our state, but anywhere? And as someone who has spent decades in law enforcement, 15 of which I was honored to be a executive, a chief or sheriff, this again points to getting away from this sort of let's demonize police or back the cop, you know, back the blue. We have to come together and figure out effective and productive ways to deal with hiring the right people, monitoring them in the right way, the right policies, the right balance between labor rights and management rights. And all that stuff is kind of boring. Supervision is another element of that. Like I said, it's sort of boring. It doesn't lend itself to hashtags and Twitter, but that's where this lives. And that's what we're about at WASPIC, is improving all of those things over time. And I think we've made real progress. I think some of the things I mentioned in terms of how Memphis handled that speak to that. Of course, we have more work to do, but again, I think getting out of our corners and continuing to move forward in a productive way to do all those things I just mentioned is where, you know, that's the productive thing that hopefully can come out of this.
Well, and productive things, like you said, they can be quote unquote boring, maybe not the sexiest things for the media, not the best headlines, but boring is often the most productive. So I want to get to some of those things. But, you know, I always wonder, I guess, you know, when you have one officer who does something egregious, kind of universally accepted as egregious, that's one thing. But when you've got a group of five, I guess, how do you even begin to try to control the type of behavior that would lead to a group action, a group think, a group mentality like that?
Yeah. Well, you're talking about, you know, culture within a group, which can be a problem. You've seen issues with this related to LA County Sheriff's Office. They've seen some of those same issues where specialty units have become highly problematic. And so that's an ongoing issue there as well. And it was one of the factors that certainly gotten a lot of attention in LA County, appropriately so. And again, I'll go back to my experience having been a chief and a sheriff. I've seen that in my career as well. And it, again, it's sort of boring, but it has to do with what controls do you have over those specialty units? What controls do you have over certain shifts within an agency so that they have the proper supervision, that if there is a culture developing there that is problematic, that it gets attention, that it doesn't fly under the radar. And that if you're hearing feedback from the community, hearing feedback from those with which they're interacting, that it's identified and dealt with. And frankly, that does belong to folks like chiefs and sheriffs. And how do we do that better? And again, I'll just say that's exactly what we do, training and development. How do we support through accreditation and peer review so that agencies can see where they have some of those gaps and improve those? And that's heavy lifting. It's difficult work. It's management, policies, and supervision. But you have to have the right number of people, the right people in place. And that is where a lot of this, you know, at the end of the day, that's how you have really productive outcomes from this.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, the specialty unit that was involved in this incident. I think it was called the Scorpion Unit. And there had been some indications that maybe there wasn't wonderful oversight of them, that there were complaints about this particular unit. Have you ever in Washington State, in the work that you've done, encountered issues like that with specialty units?
I have. I'll speak from my own experience. Mm-hmm. Having been a chief and a sheriff, I had specialty units that were making decisions that they shouldn't have been making. They were doing things they shouldn't have been. And I can tell you from hard experience, it was because they weren't being monitored and supervised correctly because of a lack of staffing. It's because the policies weren't in place to have the right controls on those units, the right filters and the right screening to make sure that we had the right people there, and then rotating them so that they, you know, there wasn't this sort of long-term placement in those specialty units, and that runs up against things like labor agreements. It's complicated, but that's the job of chiefs and sheriffs to make sure that those controls are in place. I mentioned staffing, that's an issue. You have to have enough people to do the monitoring, to do the supervision, to make sure that those things are being followed up on. And, you know, that's one of the reasons we keep talking about we need the right staffing in law enforcement in this state. I don't want to just blame it on that and use that as a cop-out. I'm just saying all those things are connected. And running agencies in a way that's reflective of what the community expects and gives the right support to the people doing the job requires those resources, and all these things are connected.
In that regard, you know, specialty units exist for a reason. Typically, they're fitting some specific sort of need, be it drug crimes or something like that. And it's difficult work in a lot of instances. It requires sometimes really deep involvement from law enforcement officers. What's the right balance, I guess? Because I think there has to be some autonomy there for them to be able to really dig in and do those jobs. So how do you strike the right balance between giving them the leeway they need to pursue their goal and their mission versus having oversight? Because I guess some would worry like, well, is it going to become too controlled, too political, too worried about optics to be effective?
Yeah. Well, you know, and there's been calls, you know, we should eliminate all of these specialty units because, you know, this, we saw this problem in this unit. It gets back to the challenge of executive leadership, which is to make sure you've got screening, to make sure you have the right people with the right tools and the right training, and frankly, the right background to do this so that they're there for the right reasons. It is very difficult work, whether it be narcotics investigation, violent crime units, gang units in some cities. All these things are, it's the same issue. And they're dealing with very, very difficult issues out there that are very dangerous. And there's a reason they're there, because the community needs that. But the right supervision and the right controls are everything. And as I said, if you see some of these specialty units over time that have become a problem, there's the same people there for a very long period of time, and they seem to develop a culture that is sometimes counter to what the agency is looking for. And there has been a couple of high-profile examples of that nationally, but that's exactly the challenge, and it's a challenge for the executive and for the managers. And we have to recognize that if it's done right, they're very appropriate.
There have been some conversations in Memphis about over the last 4 years, they've lowered their hiring standards twice. One is it pertained to work experience and education. The second time they did away with a timed physical agility test and again lowered educational requirements. Now, I think it would be an assumption to tie that to what happened to Tyre Nichols, but just more broadly, is that a relevant conversation to have? You know, as you have police departments like Seattle's down 500 officers, are we seeing in Washington State and elsewhere in the country a lowering of standards to try to fill those gaps?
It's a great question. And we should be asking that question. And it's part of the huge challenge that law enforcement is going through right now. I have not seen anyone in Washington law enforcement lowering their standards. At the same time, as you know, staffing is a gigantic challenge nationwide, and especially here in Washington State, for a number of reasons, including the environment and the economy and a lot of other things out there. We're 51st in the nation in staffing, last in the nation, and have been for over a decade. And it's getting worse. I can mention that the preliminary numbers we have is that we're going to have a net loss of about 100 more officers in 2022 than we had in 2021, when we lost almost 500 net officers statewide. So we're going the wrong direction, even with replacements. So to your question, I haven't seen agencies lowering their standards, but somebody needs to staff the street. Somebody has to be out there to respond to calls. I never had to worry in my career about, you know, are we going to have enough people to literally work on the street tonight? But there are chiefs and sheriffs who have to worry about that every single day right now. And we have officers and deputies working mandatory overtime, not as much sleep, running call to call, no decompression time, which is bad for wellness. It's bad for decision making. They don't have enough people to properly team up and slow down, which is the expectation. We're going the wrong direction. So that's part of our challenge, is how do we support good policing, get the staffing that we need for all the reasons that we've been talking about, while at the same time, there are so many pressures for people not to go into the profession. And that is what, you know, the roughly 300 sheriffs and chiefs in this state are trying to work through right now.
Yeah, and it's one of the many concerns I have about the ramifications of the defunding debate. Now, a lot of, you know, cities made threats to defund and then didn't fully follow through. But, you know, I think that just by virtue of the narrative that they started, you had a lot of officers in Seattle is a prime example that decided to retire, that decided to leave, that had a lot of experience on the department. So even though you're not seeing staffing standards lowering yet, have you seen a shift in the amount of experience on the streets in departments? Because like I said, a lot of people chose to retire perhaps earlier than they would have. And then you have new officers coming in. Does that shift in experience make a difference on the streets?
It absolutely does. And I don't know enough, for example, about the Memphis case to speak to that issue there, but I can say I certainly see and hear from chiefs and sheriffs all the time that, you know, we have sergeants who used to have 10 years on before they became a sergeant, who are now sometimes 2 and 3 year officers becoming sergeants, because it's just the numbers. It's who we have. We have people in specialty units who are younger and have less experience than was once the case. It is what it is. We have who we have, and it's not true of every single agency. I think Seattle is a more extreme case of where officers maybe felt unsupported and chose to move on, but we've seen that in a lot of other agencies, maybe not to that extreme. And certainly just a lot of people leaving the profession and just saying, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. People retiring earlier than they used to. And so the issue you raise is huge, which is, again, the necessity for supervision, controls, monitoring. And yet we're seeing a smaller pool of people who are younger that we're asking to do all those things. And it's part of the reason that I think it's so important for this state to start to get out of our corners, quit demonizing law enforcement and finding up, you know, thinking of new ways to make it a higher risk profession personally, and instead supporting good policing so that we have the right people in the right places. It's going to take years, but that's a commitment that we have to make. It's a challenge we have to take on, because what's the alternative? We can't, you know, doing what we're doing is not acceptable.
Yeah. And to just underscore your point, you know, the five officers involved in the Tyree Nichols case, they were all very young. I mean, I think they were all younger than me. So I think the oldest one was in his early 30s. But I know a lot of young officers who wouldn't brutally beat someone to death. And so how much does age and experience really factor into a situation like that? I mean, this seems to be a very, very egregious and rare instance of what happened in Memphis.
And, you know, and if I could, Randy, there's data about this, but also I'll just say when I was a 25-year-old patrol officer, I was certainly a very different person than I was as a 30 or a 35-year-old. So it isn't just age, it's also individual, you know, characteristics. But in general, what you just said is a factor.
Yeah. One more thing on Tyree Nichols, and then I want to talk to you about the pursuit bill, because I know you guys have been efforting some common sense bipartisan cooperation in Olympia. We've been talking about it quite a bit. You know, after George Floyd, we had this major reaction across the country when it came to police reforms. Some of it was productive. I would argue a lot of it wasn't productive and led to some of the challenges that we're facing today. What narrative would you like to see? What conversation would you like to see come out of what's happening in Memphis?
Again, to reinforce the work that we all have to do together in a bipartisan way. I think it's easy to say, well, we have to find ways to go after law enforcement officers civilly or do more, you know, consent decrees and to sort of force issues from that end through litigation, or toward the other end, let's just, you know, act as if this will never happen again. That was just unique to Memphis and let's not do anything. Instead, I think we've had a great conversation about this right now in terms of supporting staffing, supporting training, supporting supervision. Again, it's a little bit boring, but it's the difficult work where all of this lives, and making law enforcement an attractive profession for the people that we need that reflect the community. I think a lot of departments are doing a great job on that right now, and we have to reinforce and support that. And again, that's not conducive to one sentence or a tweet. It's difficult work that requires us to come together. You know, a few years ago, we had the 940 process, where the initiative was written, it passed. Law enforcement approached legislators and advocacy groups, including me, I was part of that, and said, we get where you're going, and we agree with much of it, but the way you wrote it isn't going to work. Can we work with you to do it in a way that's balanced and is going to be productive? And we did. It was astonishing. It was nationwide. It was leading the nation. And everyone realized that. It was great. And after the murder of George Floyd, unfortunately, things sort of changed, and decisions were made that were, created laws that while we raised issues with them, they were passed anyway. And we've spent the last couple of years trying to bring some balance so that they're more productive. I would love to see us get back to working together collaboratively, listening to all voices, and acknowledging what the community is expecting. And the change is needed. I think sheriffs and chiefs have been right at the table and in many cases leading the way on that and doing it together instead of from our corners.
One of the bills that resulted from 2020 and George Floyd was this law that in part dramatically limited when police can pursue a suspect and took a lot of that decision making out of the hands of individual officers. I was really excited when I saw these bipartisan twin bills in the House and Senate. I love anything bipartisan. I think if it's bipartisan, there's a better chance it's probably actually good, sound policy. I was thinking it would move, and then it kind of hit this roadblock in Senate Law and Justice. You're on the inside of this. Have you heard anything that we maybe haven't heard about the chances of that bipartisan proposal passing?
Really nothing additional than what I think some of the things you've been hearing and talking about. I share your optimism. Bill Bratton once said that police officers are idealists wrapped in a cloak of cynicism. I kind of agree with that. I think I'm one of those folks. I'm an idealist. And I was so excited to see, strong and very substantial bipartisan support for both bills in the House and Senate. Majority Democratic Party chief authors on both bills. And, saw some movement. And of course, there's been a roadblock now in the Senate Law and Justice Committee, which is part of the legislative process. I'll acknowledge that. I think that it would be great if our elected representatives were allowed to vote on an issue that I think is very important to them. We will continue to send the message that this is not, and I think it's an important message, this is not about partisan politics. This is not about R's and D's. This isn't about our sides. That stuff is fun. It's back and forth. This is about public safety and responding to the community. Here's my frustration. Everyone acknowledges we don't want more pursuits. We don't want more reckless driving. 745 people killed on the roadways last year. Unacceptably high. Car thefts have gone up 61% on a monthly basis since the law changed. And very importantly, we've seen that change in the atmosphere out there in terms of emboldened criminals. So all that's true. What's frustrating to me is that we have real data that shows that more than twice as many drivers are running from and fleeing from traffic stops than before the law changed. I think that's exactly the opposite of the intention of the law change, which was to make the streets safer, to limit the number of pursuits. But instead, what we're seeing is people simply driving away from law enforcement, and it's more than doubled. Real data from the state patrol that's shown that. And hopefully legislators can look at that, again, get out of our corners, come together. And nobody's asking for Dukes of Hazzard, let's, chase everybody. If this, the right approach is something that results in fewer pursuits, they should be extremely rare and only when absolutely necessary. But what we're doing right now, I just don't think is, I think everyone agrees what we're doing now doesn't work.
Yeah, we reported on this independent review that a Seattle U professor who has done, has done statistics and law enforcement, that's been his career, who said that the key statistic that Democrats are relying on to prove that that bill improved public safety, he kind of debunked it and said there's really not enough data and information for them to make a determination. They shouldn't be using that statistic that there's been a 73% drop in fatal police pursuits to inform any of their policy. And, we did a story on that. That data was sent to Senator Dingra, who chairs Law and Justice, and she just immediately
dismissed it out of hand and went back to that same statistic that the Seattle U professor said they should not be using. How frustrating is that to you that here you have this independent analysis and it's almost as if there's some lawmakers who don't want to entertain it?
Well, it is frustrating. And the fact is, you know, we appreciate the fact that, Representative Rule asked for that that study from Dr. Hickman, who is, from what I understand of his reputation, is sort of the gold standard of folks who look at these kinds of issues. But, you know, I guess I would say this. We're talking about traffic fatalities on the roadways, auto theft increases, and more than double the amount of people fleeing from the state patrol in 2022. That's real data. That's actual data. You know, we had legislators who introduced a number of bills in response to 745 people dying on our roadways just a few days ago. And they talked about, I think they used the word carnage and that it wasn't acceptable. I think it defies common sense to suggest that more people fleeing from law enforcement and criminals feeling emboldened doesn't have a relationship to all those statistics, particularly deaths on our roadways that I just mentioned. And I don't think it requires us to study that for 2 years to determine that. People feeling that they can flee with impunity is a factor in what people are concerned about right now. And I would hope that the legislature would respond to that.
Defies common sense is a good way to put it. And we'll end with what you just mentioned there. There's been this sidetrack bill that a couple Democrats have proposed that would allow a 19-person commission to study impacts of the bill until October of 2024. What are your concerns if we don't change this pursuit law this session and instead study it until 2024?
Well, we're opposed to that bill because that bill simply delays what we think is something that's important to consider right now. Last fall, people elected their legislators, many of whom heard from and talked to their constituents about this issue and that it mattered to them. Many of those legislators ran saying, I'm going to do something about this. I think they should be able to vote on it. And simply delaying it until Halloween of 2024, right before the election in 2024, means 22 more months of all the things we just talked about, including retail theft, auto theft, and frankly, violent crime and traffic deaths. That should matter. And I think, I don't think it's going to take 2 years of study with a group which, by the way, does not include anyone with an expertise in research or data and does not include anyone representing victims. I don't think that's the way to go.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the timing with the election. They finished their study at the end of October, but I'm sure there'll be a few days delay before the results of that study, if that's the route they take, were to be released. Steve Strahan, head of the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs, we appreciate your time. And what we're trying to normalize on this podcast are the boring conversations. You know, people want to have the conversations with the extremes because they are more exciting, but we need to get people used to being able to sit through, I don't think you were boring, but a conversation that talks about these issues with nuance, because that's what's going to be meaningful and impactful. So I really appreciate the way that you discuss these issues. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, and thanks for what you do.
The previous segment was brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. I want to share a brief message today with residents in Linwood who have been fighting against a proposed opioid clinic in their city. As you know, the clinic was allowed to open today, and I know that many of you are disappointed with that decision. The fight against the opioid clinic started only a month ago when the city council, and residents found out that an opioid clinic was set to open just a few yards from a Boys and Girls Club, just a few yards from a ballpark where kids play baseball, softball, t-ball. Understandably, the community was upset. They were upset because they weren't consulted. They were upset because they were worried about public safety. They were worried about people who are recovering from substance abuse using a facility so close to what is supposed to be a safe place for their kids. The residents who spoke out about this facility had every right in the world to be upset, every right in the world to be upset that they weren't consulted. And we've talked so many times on the podcast about how amazing it was, the way in which they organized themselves to come out, to go to meetings, to speak out against Acadia Health, the Washington State Department of Health, for cutting them out of the loop. Now, I kind of suspected from the beginning that this opioid clinic would be allowed to open. Even though residents just found out about it in mid-December, Acadia Health had already put something like $300,000 into renovating it. And really, what were they supposed to do? What was the Department of Health supposed to do? And people did agree that, hey, we need an opioid clinic, right? We have, you know, record high drug overdoses. We want people to get better. They need a place to be able to get better. The issue was always twofold: its proximity to kids and the fact that no one was told about it, and that this seemed to be a hidden process. The right steps weren't taken. The state really didn't care about public input on the issue. So not a surprise that it was allowed to open. But I just want to encourage those of you who fought against it not to be disappointed and not to be discouraged. Our friend Jonathan Cho went out to the Linwood Clinic after this news came down. And one of the things that he pointed out is residents are invigorated to keep being part of the conversation, to monitor this clinic, to make sure that the clinic is working with the community, to keep track of whatever safety issues might arise in the neighborhood as a result.
The setback does have a silver lining. Neighbors are now energized more than ever.
We have formed friendships and we're united.
To stay engaged and involved, to keep their community safe.
We're looking out for our community and our kids.
And to make sure something like this never happens again in Linwood.
It's disappointing.
Without their consent.
We're going to keep watching.
And so even if you think you lost, even if you think you lost, I want you to know that you didn't. I want you to know that you won. You won because for many of you, you found your voice. You realized what an impact you can have when you speak up for yourselves, when you're your own best watchdog. This clinic would have opened without anybody knowing about it had you guys not raised alarm bells, got out there, protested, contacted the media, contacted me, contacted Jonathan Cho, contacted. Eventually, this became a mainstream story. Eventually, every single news outlet, every TV station in Seattle was outside this clinic, interviewing residents, doing news stories, covering the issue that is so important. And it resulted in two things. I think it put Acadia Health on notice that it better run this clinic to the letter. And I think it will stop Acadia Health or any other similar organization from believing that they can push through one of these clinics without seriously considering the public's input. And hopefully it also put the Department of Health on notice that communities do care about these things. Communities do want a say in these things, and they deserve to have a say in these things. So again, to those in Linwood who fought against this clinic, who just wanted your voices to be heard, they were heard. They were heard by me. They were heard by so many other people, and it did make a difference. It'll make a difference for other communities in our state, and I do think it'll make a difference in how this particular clinic is operated, and you should be very, very proud of that. Okay, I want to end the show with some comments you guys had on the story we discussed at the beginning of the show about reasonable people being vilified and painted as extremists. Sally on Patreon wrote, "Good for you, Brandy. I guess one can only be empowered if they are liberals." Will on Patreon said, "This is what just about everything has become these days. If you aren't fully one of us, you are against us. There is very little middle ground anymore." And I'll say that is true for both sides. I mean, how many people on the right do you hear call moderates, Republicans, rhinos? It's like, oh, you know, you don't agree with us on everything, so you're not one of us. So it's a problem on both sides, and I want to be clear about that. Patsy on Locals wrote, "They stated the conditions. You accepted the conditions for being a speaker, and then they question your judgment. No place you need to be." And I agree. Travis on Patreon wrote, "As someone who is part of a family-owned small business in the Kent Valley, I find the behavior of the Kent Chamber egregious and reprehensible, but sadly par for the course. I do not want to hear another word about supporting women from the left because it's just code for support leftist women." And I couldn't agree more. You know, the left is always like, support women, but it should have an asterisk that says accept conservative women. And I thought about this one day. I was in line at a Target, and I was looking at the magazines, and it was like athletes and political figures and actresses. And I just thought, none of those women are conservative. And so you're painting in the brain of women who look at those magazines and look at who's celebrated and lifted up as being a status symbol or a beauty symbol or a fashion symbol or a success in business, etc. And to me, it just screams, you can't be this if you're conservative. And I, you know, Melania Trump was a good example of this. And there was an issue raised, I think Donald Trump raised it, that Melania Trump was like not give Trump, Melania Trump was not given covers, a lot of covers in like the fashion magazines, even though she was indisputable, a very fashionable first lady. And it's because of her politics. And now you see Jill Biden, who has okay fashion, I guess, who's on all these covers and just elegant and celebrated. And look, at the time, was that the biggest issue in the world, that his wife wasn't gracing the cover of magazines? No. But I do think Donald Trump had a very valid point about the way that conservative women are treated differently in the media ecosystem than liberal women. We'll end with TJ on Patreon. Some of us fought hard for the American experiment to succeed, and I will never stop doing so to my last breath. I love it, TJ, and that's why you're a subscriber on Patreon. We all have this mission to give common sense a comeback, to give a voice to reasonable people, and to, in doing so, try to not silence the fringes, because I don't want anyone to be silenced per se, but to make sure they understand that they are not the majority and their voices and their opinions do not reflect the majority of Americans. All right, that's it for this episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. If you're not a subscriber already, we're really close to reaching a goal I set to add 250 new subscribers in January. There's just one day left. So if you've been holding on saying, I don't know if I want to spend $5 a month on that, now is a great time to do it. You can become a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/undivided, or you can become a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com.